This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Monday, November 11th. Today, the prehistory of the Trump-Ukraine scandal. With the first public hearing scheduled for this Wednesday and Friday, how did we really get here? Philip Bump and Aaron Blake from The Washington Post have put together what they call the full Trump-Ukraine timeline. Philip Bump joins us now to talk about the 5 years, yes, 5 years, leading up to the infamous Trump-Zelensky phone call in July of this year and the larger scheme to tie military aid and a White House meeting to Ukraine investigating Trump's political rivals. Philip, we appreciate this really useful timeline and your own time today. Thanks for coming on.
You bet.
It's called the full Trump-Ukraine timeline, but it really starts almost 3 years before Trump becomes president. Your first entry is February 22nd, 2014, when the pro-Russia president, Viktor Yanukovych, is ousted during a popular uprising against him, and he flees to Russia. Why start there?
That's a great question, because it actually does go well before that, as I'm sure probably most listeners know. We decided to start at that point because that was really the trigger point for most of the tension between Russia and the U.S. It was a pro-Russian leader in Ukraine who was ousted by out of popular demand, and that really started the tension between those two countries, which I think informed a lot of what followed.
Your timeline notes that Yanukovych had come to power with the help of Paul Manafort,
right,
who would go on to be Trump's campaign chairman. Why did Paul Manafort, an American political consultant, want to help the guy who was helping Russia expand its influence by dominating Ukraine?
Because they gave him money to do that. Paul Manafort was never one who was putting ethics before profits. He worked for a long period of time with a number of people of questionable repute, including in the Philippines and in other places. And he was very involved in what was called the Party of Regions, which was Yanukovych's political party, helped him get into that position, which then later on, I don't want to, you know, give any spoilers here, but we'll come back to burn him and be involved in all this in the future.
And the next month, March 2014, a month after Manafort's client Yanukovych is forced out, Russia isn't having this new resistance to it, and that's when it invades the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea and annexes it, such a pivotal event, just takes it back as part of Russia, March 2014. 2 months later, May 13th, 2014, Hunter Biden joins the board of Burisma, owned by Mykola Zlochevsky, one of several subjects of a Ukrainian corruption probe. Can you tell us more about that? Why did Hunter Biden, son of the sitting vice president at that time, 2014, join Burisma's board?
It's a good question. I don't know that I've heard a really detailed response from him on that. I think that his motivation was probably not unlike Paul Manafort's, which is that they were paying him money to do that. He was in the business of providing advisory services to companies, and my guess is that was probably a primary motivator.
And now here comes something related to that that I think we're very likely to hear about on day one of the public hearings on Wednesday, early 2015 now. And one of the witnesses who will testify on Wednesday, State Department official George Kent, raises concerns about Hunter Biden's work with Burisma, but Joe Biden's office turns him away, as you put it. Can you elaborate on what George Kent's concern was about Hunter Biden being on that board and what he says the interaction with Joe Biden's office was like?
Yeah, so I mean, there were obvious reasons, and this actually came up later during President Obama's actual administration. There are obvious reasons to be concerned about Hunter Biden's involvement with this company and his involvement with Ukrainian power more broadly. Kent says that he raised this issue with Biden's office. This was at the time when Beau Biden, Joe Biden's other son, was dying of brain cancer. And so he was told essentially, look, we don't have time to worry about Hunter Biden right now, where the vice president's focused on Beau Biden. But the impression that one gets from Kent in particular is that he was not particularly satisfied with the response that he got in terms of his concerns about that possible conflict.
So I guess we'll hear Republicans question him about that on Wednesday. But the next four entries on your timeline are about people wanting Ukraine's chief prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, fired for not investigating corruption. And these seem to establish that the way the Trump people are trying to portray Joe Biden's role in getting that Ukrainian prosecutor, Viktor Shokin, fired at the time is totally misleading. September 24th, 2015, Jeffrey Pyatt, then U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, blasts Shokin in a speech in Odessa, Ukraine. He points to a glaring problem that threatens the good work regional leaders are doing, the failure of the institution of the Prosecutor General of Ukraine to successfully fight internal corruption. Then October 8th, Assistant U.S. Secretary of State Victoria Nuland testifies to the Senate that Shokin's office has to be reinvented as an institution that serves the citizens of Ukraine rather than ripping them off. That's a quote. Then December 8th, 2015, in Kiev, Biden tells Ukrainian leaders to fire Shokin or lose more than $1 billion in loan guarantees. That's what the Republicans are calling Biden's quid pro quo. Right. But for context, as you point out, Biden joins many Western leaders in urging Shokin's ouster. And as a further example of that, a few months later, February 10th, 2016, the International Monetary Fund threatens to halt a bailout program for Ukraine unless the country addresses its issues, which includes firing Viktor Shokin. Right. So the point there, very important point, is there's overwhelming evidence that Viktor Shokin was not fired as a way to ease up on Hunter Biden. The whole Western world wanted him fired because he wasn't investigating corruption in Ukraine.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the idea from Republicans is that Shokin was going hard against Burisma and therefore Joe Biden wanted to crack down on him. And it's, in fact, the opposite is the case, is that Shokin wasn't cracking down on corruption, that Burisma, there's not evidence beyond from Shokin himself, who obviously is not a reliable narrator here. There's not evidence that Burisma was actually under investigation at the time that that Shokin was fired. Shokin was essentially, according to all these various people, falling down on the job and not actually tackling this systemic problem that had Americans concerned. Americans were concerned at that time legitimately about how much do we support Ukraine when Ukraine is a corrupt political institution? Shokin being there was seen as an obstacle to real reform, and that is why all of these leaders, including at that time Joe Biden, were focused on him and his removal.
And then on March 29th, 2016, Shokin is finally fired in the weeks after the International Monetary Fund threatened to halt a bailout program. So maybe it had nothing to do with Joe Biden or the U.S. Secretary of State or the U.S.-Ukraine ambassador, but it was when the IMF said they're going to withhold the green that they finally fired Viktor Shokin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was a culmination of a lot of different pressures that Ukraine was feeling at that point in time.
January 12th, 2017, Trump is already elected. It's 8 days before he's sworn in. And Ukraine closes its investigation of Burisma, though the new chief prosecutor, Lutsenko, says one sale of an oil storage terminal will still be investigated. Do you know basically what they found ultimately in the investigation of Burisma corruption?
I don't. And it's interesting because this is actually Burisma saying at that point in time, all of these things have been closed. So we're not really sure on when they were actually closed out. Because again, remember, the idea is that in the late 2015, early 2016 timeframe, when Shokin was being targeted, Burisma wasn't apparently under investigation. So this may have been something that emerged after that under the new president, Petroshenko, who of course is not currently the president. So it's not really clear what actually happened with the Burisma thing. That's part of one of the mysteries here. And part of that too stems from the fact that Ukraine's politics are a little murky.
And that date is interesting in part, as I think you were suggesting in that answer. The investigation of Burisma was not closed when Joe Biden was president, suggesting some kind of pressure to save Hunter Biden from anything that they may have acted on, only after Biden was leaving.
Right.
So that helps establish that there's no evidence for that. However, let's jump ahead to something in your timeline that perhaps could help Trump's defense. January 11th, 2017, or I guess we're really jumping back one day, so it's the same week, January 11th, 2017, just before Trump is inaugurated, Politico reports that Ukrainian officials, quote, helped Clinton's allies research damaging information on Trump and his advisors during the campaign, unquote. Now, Philip, it seems to me this could become central to a Trump defense that getting campaign help from a foreign country is more common than the press and the Democrats are making it seem. And oh, by the way, both parties do it and both parties did it in 2016. But how much was that political angle proven?
Right. No, it's a great point. And I think it's important to remember January 2017, the media was obsessed over what we were just then learning about Russia's role interfering in the 2016 election, you know, 2 months prior the election actually occurred. So we were just starting to learn that the CIA and the FBI were concerned about what Russia had done. And so Politico comes out and says, hey, we've uncovered this Ukrainian thread, too. The big difference is the scale of the efforts, right? The Ukraine effort, there was a woman who worked as a consultant for the Democratic National Committee who has subsequently been called as a potential witness by Republicans in this House inquiry. But she was essentially trying to dig up. She went to the Ukrainian embassy and said, hey, what do you got on Manafort? Because again, as I said, people are really focused on, look, there's got to be something we can find on Paul Manafort, given his history. So that's one of the really central parts of this political piece is a woman from the DNC went to the Ukrainian embassy and asked them for help on Manafort. That's very, very different than both the scale of what happened with Russia in 2016 and who was actually leading the effort. I mean, that was, according to reports, driven by Vladimir Putin himself saying, let's focus on this in 2016. So it's very different, but you're exactly right. Donald Trump and his allies are very much, you know, they're very prone to sort of whataboutism, and they have lifted up this article repeatedly as an example of Ukraine being a bad actor as well or equivalently.
Ahead 3 months now to April 21st, 2017. So Trump is in office for a few months, and he, for the first time, tweets this conspiracy theory that Russia didn't hack the DNC and release all those emails damaging to Hillary Clinton in the final weeks of the campaign. It was actually Ukraine that hacked the DNC, and they did it not to help Trump, but to help Clinton. And now this is widely called a debunked conspiracy theory by now, we should say. But what was the theory even based on? How could dropping all those bad for Hillary emails be a way to help her win the election?
So again, keep in mind that what Donald Trump is trying to do at this point, he's very concerned about the Russian investigation at this point. April 2017, right before he fires James Comey, he'd been asking James Comey behind the scenes, according to Comey, hey, you lift this cloud, I've got Russia hanging over my head. So what Donald Trump's trying to do here is distract. During the 2016 campaign, shortly after, there's this conspiracy theory that emerged, and that the link goes, the first analysis of the DNC server was done by a company called Cloudflare. A guy who helped co-found Cloudflare sits on the board of this nonprofit organization. That nonprofit organization receives some funding from a Ukrainian oligarch. That's the tie that is the ostensible link between Ukraine and the server. It's you know, calling it debunked is generous. It's nonsensical in a lot of ways. It is also the focus of what would later be Trump's first ask to President Zelensky.
Just for the record, Cloudflare, or I think I've heard CrowdStrike.
CrowdStrike, yes.
CrowdStrike,
yes. Not to disparage a company unfairly, yes.
CrowdStrike is the name of that company. May 2nd, 2018, now we get into last year, Ukraine stops cooperating with Robert Mueller in the Russia investigation. Then May 4th, 2 days later, three Democratic senators, Durbin, Leahy, and Menendez, write to Ukraine's prosecutor, Lutsenko, to ask him to reconsider. Now, Philip, Trump supporters will ask, why was a foreign country cooperating with the Mueller investigation into a U.S. political scandal? And is that any different from what Trump is asking Ukraine to do with investigating their theory of 2016 election interference on the other side?
Right. And I think that's a fair question. I think it's important to note that the New York Times reported that Ukraine had been reticent to help the Mueller probe, recognizing how President Trump felt about the Mueller probe. And so they were sort of making a geopolitical decision. Do we go out of our way to anger Donald Trump by helping with this thing? This was a probe that was sanctioned by Donald Trump's own Justice Department. This was a special counsel that was appointed by, you know, the Deputy Attorney General. It was a very different thing than Donald Trump sort of speculatively saying, hey, maybe there's something on Joe Biden. If you could find something, dig something up, or at least make an announcement about it, that would be helpful.
And based on what we discussed before, maybe the difference is the Mueller investigation was real. The whole intelligence community concluded Russia hacked the DNC, and Mueller actually indicted a dozen individual Russians with mountains of evidence, while the theory that it was really Ukraine was only ever a political trick, a fabrication made up to cast doubt on the Russia investigation to help save Trump. So, of course, Ukraine would help with one and not help with another.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of what we're seeing in the most recent testimony is Ukraine found itself in the same geopolitical bind once Trump started making those asks. But it certainly was rational for Ukraine to have a response of, okay, this is a legitimate investigation versus this is something that is the will of the president.
Now we get to this year and some of the intrigue that we'll be hearing about in the public hearings. You have on March 20th of this year, Ukraine's chief prosecutor, Yuri Lutsenko, tells a pro-Trump American journalist, John Solomon of The Hill, that our ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, gave him a list of people who we should not prosecute. In other words, Yovanovitch is being tarred as corrupt, it's at least implied there, and trying to protect corrupt people. But you're right that the State Department called the claim an outright fabrication at the time. So let me focus on that. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, State Department, defended Yovanovitch?
Yeah, I mean, this was a claim that was later retracted by Lutsenko a month or two later. It was pretty obviously not true, and it was, in fact, Lutsenko trying to give information. I mean, keep in mind that at this point in time as well, Ukraine is going through its next presidential election. Lutsenko is the general prosecutor. He's worried about his job. He thinks that if the then-current president, Petroshenko, is out of office, he may lose his position. And so it seems quite likely that he is actually trying to engage in some political machinations that will boost Petroshenko's chances.
By endearing themselves to the Trump administration?
Yes, exactly.
Because they already know Trump doesn't like Yovanovitch.
Right. And they also know by now that Rudy Giuliani is very actively trying to dig up dirt in Ukraine. And so they're trying to give him this. And Giuliani and Solomon have an interesting relationship through another pair of lawyers that's very complex and detailed. But so Giuliani has this tie to Solomon. Solomon's interviewing this guy. Giuliani has already talked to people who are involved in this whole thing as well. So all of this is sort of an emergence to the surface of something that's sort of been in the works for months, trying to figure out how they talk about Ukraine in Trump-friendly terms.
April 24th of this year, Ambassador Yovanovitch gets that 1 a.m. phone call that's been in the news now from a State Department official that Yovanovitch revealed at her testimony recently, telling her to come home from Ukraine on the next plane for the sake of her security.
Right.
Philip, most of the public started to hear only in September about Trump and Rudy and the shadow foreign policy toward Ukraine,
right,
designed to advantage Trump personally. But all of this stuff we've just been talking about took place in earlier months this year. That phone call to Yovanovitch was in April. That made-up smear against her by the Ukrainian prosecutor was in March. Most of the public started to hear about all this only in September after the whistleblower complaint,
right,
became public. But in May of this year is when this story did begin to break out publicly a little bit for people paying really close attention to the news. May 1st, the New York Times publishes an article asking whether Biden's role in pressing for Prosecutor Shokin's ouster back in 2014, 2015, had anything to do with Hunter Biden being on the board of Burisma and portraying it as a potential liability to Biden's 2020 campaign. But then May 7th, 6 days later, a Bloomberg News article casts doubt on the Times article. Can you explain how the two news organizations were at odds in the first week of May?
Well, I think part of it is the function just of the, you know, I keep using the word murky, but with justification. It's really unclear about what was going on at that point in time. And the people at the center of it, Shokin and Lutsenko, for example, were not necessarily always forthright in terms of what they'd actually done. I think it's important to note that that May article in the Times is from Ken Vogel, who actually happened to be the same guy at Politico who'd reported the first Ukraine thing, which I always find an interesting parallel. But essentially what Bloomberg had done is looked at what had been reported by the Times in May 1st and sort of dug into it a little bit further and found some of the gaps that we now recognize. Since, of course, the whistleblower complaint was made public, a lot more gaps have emerged and you know, the extent to which there probably wasn't even a lot of smoke there has been revealed.
May 9th this year, Rudy Giuliani tells the New York Times he will travel to Ukraine to push for investigations. And right away, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut tweets that everyone should take note that the president is asking a foreign country to investigate his political rival. Not much of the press did take note that early, May 9th. So this really, however, for people who were paying attention, broke out in May.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. I think it's safe to say. You know, and the Giuliani, I think that his interview with the Times on May 9th will become one of the key factors here, because in that interview, he essentially says, I was working for my client. If this happened to benefit the United States more broadly, then great. When, again, remember that Trump's argument is that he was solely thinking about what was good for the United States and rooting out corruption in Ukraine and not trying to give them money if they were a corrupt organization or a corrupt country. That Giuliani was so forthright in going to Ukraine and trying to dig this dirt up specifically for Trump's personal benefit, I think will become something that sort of hovers over all of this.
Igael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. My question is this. We have seen in the reveal of the communication with Ukraine that Trump has done a quid pro quo, and I'm almost positive that he's done more quid pro quo with more head of states that he's been in conversation with since the beginning of his presidency. How long will we have to wait to get these calls, to make these calls public? Because I'm sure there's more evidence that he is running the country for his benefit.
Well, I think that there are a lot of legitimate reasons that, that these conversations between President Trump and foreign leaders would be kept under wraps. You know, obviously, there is an exceptional nature to this particular conversation, the July 25th call that, that has become a focus of so much attention, and that the White House reportedly tried to spirit it away to this super secure server, which is abnormal. The fact that Bill Taylor, who is the acting ambassador in Ukraine, says that he was never even briefed on that conversation, which is very bizarre, since obviously this was a conversation that affected him directly. That said, there certainly are reasons that there are times in which the president doesn't want to actually reveal the contents of his calls with foreign leaders for very good national security reasons. And so I don't know that we're ever going to see the full documentation of all of these until, you know, whatever the National Archives laws are that, that these get released.
So listeners, that's some of the prehistory of what you may already know about Trump-Ukraine. But Philip, while you're here, let me touch on some developments from over the weekend.
Sure.
The Republicans let it be known this weekend that they want to call Hunter Biden and the whistleblower as witnesses for these televised hearings. Let's leave the whistleblower aside. We know the arguments against that. But what about Hunter Biden? Do the Democrats solely get to decide if the Republicans may call Hunter Biden?
Well, they do. They are in the majority. They are get to sign off on what the witness list actually looks like. I think there will be pressure on the Democrats to allow at least one or two of these witnesses simply because they want to show it as being as open as possible. I think that's why the witness list is what it is, because it's a lot of people. I think, honestly, the most fascinating person on that list is Alexander Chalupa, who is that DNC staffer who is the one who was seeking the information on Manafort, which is very much a totally separate issue. It has nothing to do with what President Trump did with Zelensky, what he did with Ukraine. But it is an effort to try and bolster this idea that there was something untoward that Ukraine had done. The Hunter Biden thing is interesting. I'm very skeptical, in part because of political reasons, that the Democrats will actually have him be a witness. But it's clear that what the Republicans are hoping to do is to continue to be able to paint this as something where they did not have a part in it in any substantial way.
What would the Democrats' excuse be for not allowing the Republicans to call Hunter Biden? I could imagine the Republicans making a big thing of this and, you know, a lot of people taking this seriously and saying, okay, Democrats, you insist the Bidens did nothing wrong, so there's nothing to investigate here. Let the guy be answering questions.
I think there's probably two arguments that'll be used. You know, whether or not people accept them is up to them. I think the first argument is that this is calling Hunter Biden and focusing on Hunter Biden does reinforce exactly what Donald Trump wanted to get out of this, which was questions about the Bidens. But then secondarily, it's not clear that Hunter Biden can inform anything about how Trump interacted with Ukraine. The question isn't necessarily why he was making these requests of Ukraine. The question was what he did with Ukraine and the way that he tried to leverage power to do so.
Philip Ump, national correspondent for The Washington Post, among his many articles, is a detailed timeline of what we've been calling the Trump-Ukraine scandal, starting with February 2014. Good reading if you want to dig that deep. Thank you for sharing so much of it with us.
My pleasure.
Again, listeners, you can call and ask an impeachment news question. Just leave a voicemail anytime, including your name and where you're calling from, and some of you will hear your questions on the show. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-TALK or 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.